Hi, I'm Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And this is Start Writing.
And today we are going to cover Villains and Antagonists Part 2. I've received several emails about people waiting for this episode to come out. I think we had 2 or 3 months in between the first one and this one. So we are ready to dive into the second part of this finally. So the first thing I want to talk about is political villains versus physical villains, and why that distinction is important, and why sometimes both is really good to have. So the political villain derives their power from wealth and influence, whereas physical villains pose a physical threat. So the one of the best ways to think about this is you've got Lex Luthor. He is wealthy. He's influential. He can bribe people. He can, you know, not even bribe, even just, you know, through campaign donations and the nature of wealth, influence, and politics. He is a political villain. And in a physical confrontation against Superman, he doesn't have a chance. He'll just get beaten to a pulp, right? But he doesn't fight physically because that's not the kind of villain he is. Whereas General Zod, on the other hand, is a physical villain, and he goes up against Superman in this physical combat of skill and strength. And so here's why these two dynamics kind of are important and can kind of go hand in hand. With the physical villain, the antagonist serves a very distinct purpose, right? We see a very real threat to Superman physically, right? But not only that, as they fight, we get to see the full range of Superman's powers and abilities, right? It's not like he's fighting a street criminal. He has to be pushed and challenged to defeat this villain to the limits of his own abilities there. So another example is Voldemort.
Wait, can we pause for a sec?
Yeah.
So Superman, I would say, is a physical protagonist.
Yeah, well, most protagonists are. Not all, but most.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Like, he's missing the political side. He doesn't have the wealth and power. I guess Bruce Wayne does.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll talk about Batman. I didn't put him in the notes, but we might talk about him and why he's almost a problematic protagonist because he has both.
Okay. Huh. Whoa, interesting. Well, so Superman, how does he manage to defeat his political enemy?
Well, that's the whole point. We'll get there in a second.
Okay.
But I mean, with the physical villain, so we can look at, like, Voldemort is a physical villain, and Harry works to fight him in every book. So evil, cruelty of the physical villain, they provoke rage and anger and hate towards them. That's kind of, you know, how they work. The political villain, like I said, they derive their power from wealth and influence. And this is why Lex Luthor is such an interesting villain for Superman, because he poses that problem. For all Superman's supernatural abilities, you know, lasers from his eyes, whirlwind breath, he can fly, he's bulletproof, none of them can help him beat Lex Luthor. He forces Superman to deal with the problem in a way that he is not superhuman. He has to.
He's not super clever.
Right. He's not super clever. And he has to fight against, you know, Luthor, who works in the world of politics. He is familiar with, you know, how wealth drives the engines of economies and everything. And yet he is corrupt and terrible. And Superman has to find a way to beat that. And again, it forces him into a very human space. It challenges him in a way that being a Kryptonian doesn't help. And that is the beauty and the frustration of the political villain versus the physical protagonist, right? It forces them to say, but how do you solve that problem?
So you could probably apply this to any protagonist where you say, this is his main weakness. This is the main gap in his abilities, and build your antagonist around that gap.
So we have Voldemort, who's a very physical villain, and oftentimes the crony that we encounter in each story is. But think about Mrs. Umbridge, right, and her abuse of power as head of Hogwarts. She's a political villain, and Harry has no idea how to fight her. And it's incredibly frustrating, and I think that's kind of the nature of the counter-protagonist-antagonist, right? If you take a physical antagonist, you put them against a political villain, it's very frustrating because they don't have the tools to combat that. And, you know, you could inverse it. If you have a political protagonist versus a physical villain, again, They don't have the tools to combat that. And that's, you know, it's an area where you can really challenge your protagonists because it puts them in an area where they are not the best.
So we don't have to reframe this for the whole episode, but just for this concept. I'm thinking of this as not political, but social. For some reason, Gordon Freeman from Half-Life came to mind. Like, he's a nerdy engineer. And his skills are the Lex Luthor kind, where he's strong in mind, and he has to go through this game against these physical threats, where suddenly he's completely out of his league. He's no action hero.
Right.
He's a nerd, and he's going up against the opposite. Anyway, it's just like, I guess it was helpful to think of it as social. Like with Umbridge, if Harry had tried to beat her up, he would have been socially outcast. He would lose that fight if he did that.
Yeah. Well, and so that brings us to the question, what happens when we have both, right? And so this can set up some really interesting dynamics. So we'll talk about Bruce Wayne now. So let's assume Batman catches the Joker, and the DA at the time is Harvey Dent, and he's working with the Joker. And so now we have a political villain and a physical villain. Batman goes into the physical encounter with the Joker. Very difficult, but he wins. And then the DA says, we don't have enough evidence to hold him, and he lets him go. And now, until the political villain is dealt with, that's a loop. No matter how many times the Joker is beaten and caught, he just walks free because the political villain creates that immunity until they're dealt with. And again, now, like I said, Batman he doesn't have this flaw, right? He's this brilliant, wealthy individual who also has the physical set. So he's too well-rounded for the political, physical offset, right? So he's problematic that way. Huh. But you can see in the example how that plays out. So we even see this a lot of times in like video games, this concept of immunity. Because what happens is, as you play the game, you become stronger physically. Your character essentially becomes this unstoppable juggernaut by the end of the game. So much so that a raw physical opponent no longer challenges you. And so often the final battle is preceded by dealing with the immunity of the boss. You've got to deal with some kind of puzzle that has nothing to do with your physical prowess to wipe away their immunities before you can actually fight them. And again, it sets this same dynamic, setting up a puzzle that no longer plays to your strengths for you to solve to remove that immunity.
Cool. There's not a specific game you're thinking about when you give
that. No, but I mean, I've encountered this so many times in games that, I mean, if I thought about it for, you know, a while, I could probably start listing them off because it happens a lot. But yeah, and so that's the political villain versus the physical villain and how you can kind of play one or the other or both to strengthen the story that way. So, cause yeah, I mean, how, you know, particularly if Lex Luthor breaks no laws and yet is terrible and corrupt and causing all kinds of mayhem, what can Superman do?
Yeah, he's such a good bad guy.
So, well, I think, and I mean, within this comic books, they've often rolled him into a physical villain. He uses kryptonite, he creates machines and all that.
Yeah.
But initially the purpose was to create a villain that Superman just was puzzled by. Be like, how do I stop him if he breaks no laws and yet at the same time he's the driving force of evil in the world? How do you fight that? And that is the grand puzzle that he's faced with often. How do I stop someone like that? Okay, so complicating the villain, charm, wit, and others. And so this is a kind of a complicated thing. So we talked about humanizing them, you know, so we can connect to them, understand their motives and their goals, and even presenting the idea of possible redemption for the villains and the antagonist in part one. But here we're looking at complicating them in a different way. So in our episode Cats and Dogs, we discuss techniques for making your protagonist likable, mainly which is save the cat, which is the character is awesome, and pet the dog, which is relatability, or the character is like me, connecting them to the character. So I'm not going to dig in a ton to that. What you can do then to complicate your villain is you can give these to the villain as well. The one thing you need to do, though, is what's called kick the cat, right? So in Cats and Dogs, one of the elements of psychology and science we talk about is first impressions. how that impacts our perception and kind of shapes how we see everything else those people do. We talk about how a lot of things that the characters do are actually kind of neutral, but if we've saved the cat, then those neutral things can appear positive because it's shaped that perspective. So Kick the Cat is about introducing the villain as a villain. This is the antagonist. This is very clear, and that first impression is negative, so that we view the other things they do negatively. And so...
Wait, so Kick the Cat means destroy a poor creature very with much finesse, right?
It just means set up a situation where we meet this character and we say, that's the villain, right? So I think in my novel, in the opening scenes, you meet Alvaro. And in the closing thing, there's a drunk American and he is just really harassing him. And he's just on the street and he decides to kill a guy. And that's it, and just leaves him there. And like, I even remember getting a feedback from a reader once, and he says, "That's the villain." Right? I mean, there's a lot that goes on in the earlier parts of the scene where you're meeting and understanding him and his motives, but that's what you're supposed to walk away from at the end of the chapter. It's like, "That's the villain." Mm-hmm. And now, you know, regardless of the other choices he will make in the book, he's the villain, and I know that. Right, and so that's what Kick the Cat is about.
Is there a contrast to Pet the Dog?
No.
Throttle the dog.
No. So there's just a contrast about shaping that first impression. So then to complicate the villain, you can then give them a save the cat moment and a pet the duck moment. And that complicates them because now it's like, yeah, they're bad, but, you know. And so it's something to consider. So if look at villains like Tyrion Lannister.
Who I can't even think of him as a villain.
By the end of the series, you don't. But in the first book, you're kind of like, maybe, you know. You're not really sure where you stand with Tyrion. And Jaime Lannister, you know, again, by the end of the first book, that's a villain.
He is the most villainous of villains.
By the end of book three, you're like, man, I like Jaime, right? Yeah. And so through these complicating moments, it's kind of shifted how we feel about these antagonists. So yeah, so you can complicate them by putting these kind of moments in there. And why would you complicate a villain? Like, why do this? So one is a novel is an emotional roller coaster, and part of that is the unexpected,
it's
right?
Fun.
Like a blanket evil villain is predictable, but a person both good and evil, both repulsive and relatable, is complicated and less predictable. So even the reader might be unsure of the outcome they want. Like, what do you want for Jaime? He's done a lot of terrible stuff, but I kind of get him, and he's been through some terrible stuff too, right? Like, what is justice for someone like Jaime? That's complicated. You know, when the war for the game of for the Iron Throne is over, what does Jaime deserve? I don't know.
It's so interesting.
But yeah.
So it's almost like you're not reading to see what happens, or I don't know. You're reading to see what might happen, or what might be justice. I guess I don't quite get that. I like it.
But now we're going to why you wouldn't want to complicate your villain, right?
Okay.
Why you wouldn't do this? So first of all, YA and younger readers, books tend to have blanket villains. Like the villain is just the villain. That's kind of the style there. And part of that is, that, you know, once you've finished growing up, people tend to appreciate the gray of life and choices. You know, teenagers and younger want things simple. It's, you know, it's partly about just like the psychology and just how brain development works within those ages, right? Where adults, we can see complexities and choices be, you know, like there's compromise and, you know, there's, you know, sometimes we make rash choices and sometimes we take more time to think it through. And sometimes, you know, we even juggle which thing we want more in the moment. And we understand that as choices being complicated. Whereas in those same kind of choices, adolescents just see hypocrisy, you know, be like, no, that's just hypocrisy. We're like, well, it couldn't be that simple. People are complicated, right? But that's, you know, and the younger you go, the more black and white they see the world. And again, that's just about the brain finishing its development. And so that's why in YA and younger, you tend to see just blanket evil villains. You know, simple, black and white. This is good. This is evil. Harry Potter. Voldemort is evil. There's no redeeming qualities there. You know, we never think, meh, maybe not, or maybe there's redemption. No, we never think that. Be like, finish him! Finish him! Right? So he's just kind of, you know, and so knowing your audience is a lot of whether or not you're going to choose to complicate that villain. And also the type of story you're telling. A lot of times in your superhero storytelling, that audience, even if you're writing for a more adult audience, is still very much looking for black and white story. So, you know, there are certain genres where a complicated villain is a powerful driver of the story. You know, most fantasy is black and white villains, but if you look at the success of Game of Thrones, it's not.
Yeah, man, I've never read a more gray book.
Yeah. Who is the good guy? Well, I like John.
Wow.
I think we've covered this in other episodes, but because this is kind of the antagonist villain suite, I want to bring it up again here. And that is avoiding the underpowered antagonist, right? You know, when it has to be David versus Goliath and we are cheering for David, you know, that's very much how it has to be. Underpowered villains are not going to provoke anger, and frustration from your reader. And without provoking those emotions towards them from the reader, there's not going to be a satisfaction when they get their comeuppance, you know,
you're just going to feel like the hero is a bully.
Yeah. Yeah.
and the bad guy was picked on.
So, and again, the stronger the villain, the more heroic the protagonist, right? I think we mentioned this before, right? A dragon slayer is a dragon slayer because they kill the dragon, right? Without a dragon, he's just a guy with a sword. So, managing antagonist plot against terrible monologues. So first of all, let's talk about what monologues are and why. Why are monologues? Because they've been around forever and they still happen. No matter how much people say it's not a great tool for storytelling, it's, you know, like stay away from, no matter how much that's being said, monologues still happen. Like, even The Incredibles, where they make fun of monologues, still has a monologue, right? Like, he gives the monologue and then he makes fun of himself for giving it. But they still did it right there, right? So, the monologue serves several purposes. It informs the audience of the antagonist's plans, and that creates tension. So, we'll break it down into four key points here. So, we know the antagonist's goal, and this raises the stakes because we now know what's really at risk. We know how they plan to achieve it, and this creates foreshadowing and tension. We know or can guess at what must be done and how difficult it will be to stop it. Again, we create tension and curiosity. How will the protagonist stop this from happening? And it presents all of this in a single scene, sometimes in a single chunk of dialogue. So it keeps it really tight and it's close together so you can see how each element is connected to the next. Right. And you know, seeing that, you're like, oh, monologues are kind of good that way. Like, yeah, they serve a very specific purpose and they've been around for so long because they do it really tight and neatly. But that doesn't mean it's great storytelling because it's kind of weird. Why are you suddenly telling me all of this when you're just about to kill me? Right. we'll address each part here and some ways that you can think about it. But at the end of the day, one of the things I'm just going to have to tell you is you've got to be creative, you know?
Yeah.
So the antagonist goal. We need to know this for tension and understanding context, why they're doing what they're doing, right? And it gives us a gauge for the stakes. Every time they are successful or draw closer to their ultimate goal, the stakes are raised. But if we don't know what that is, we can't measure their successes and how close they're getting. So, but we don't necessarily need this in a monologue, right? This can come a lot of different ways. So it can easily take place between the antagonist and his minions, right? He's laying out the plans, what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And this is what pieces I need you guys to handle.
Well, and yeah, that's just a key distinction that it's hard to think of a good reason that the bad guy would tell the good guy what he's up to.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of good reasons that the bad guy would tell his underlings what they're up to because they need to know.
Because they need to know.
Like they're carrying it out. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Very natural, authentic.
So, or because we're dealing in literature, we can even go into the antagonist's head. He can think about these things. And we use interiority to explore them, right? As another tool to go over the goal and the steps needed to achieve it. Right. And so we, and that, that, those same techniques apply to, again, how we're going to achieve that goal, right? What the goal is, how we're going to achieve it. So then we have to deal with the protagonist counter, because that's part of what comes out of the monologue as well. So there's a lot of different ways he can discover the plans, right? Maybe he sneaks in and he finds them, or maybe he's hiding in an air vent and he overhears them. You know, or he's interrogating someone that he's caught. You know, there's a lot of different ways that we can extract this information in a way that's not overly contrived and feels out of place.
Or the hero could see essentially the first phase of the plan roll out.
Yeah.
And then solve it. Like, oh my gosh, why would someone do that?
Why do that?
Unless they were trying to.
Yeah, we can extrapolate it that
so,
way.
So, yeah.
So again, there's a lot of different places you can put the protagonist encountering this information in a way that, you know, isn't the monologue. So, and again, trying to get the all in one is going to take even more acrobatic. But it doesn't mean it can't be done, right? So imagine you lay out the scene. Here's the villain and his underlings, and he's explaining the plan and the goal, the plan, what everybody's got to do. And in the air vent is the hero listening to everything. We've now, you know, maybe it's not one half page monologue. Maybe it's 3 pages, but it's all still really tight and neat. And so, I mean, even if it's not that, you know, if the antagonist explains it in one scene and the hero discovers it in one chapter and the hero discovers it in the next, again, we kept things fairly tight and close together that way. So you're going to want to keep these tight, because that is part of the beauty of the monologue, is because the reader isn't pulled far out from each one to put the pieces together themselves, right? The monologue keeps everything really close. So if there's anything you need to fill in, you've got all the information right there in that one dialogue on how to fill it in. Whereas if it's spread out over 10 chapters, the reader may not be able to put all the pieces in. They'd be like, oh yeah, way back when we talked about that. Yeah, so that's monologues. Anything else for you on that?
No.
All right. So an ensemble of antagonists. We see an ensemble of protagonists a lot, but you also see this very...
This is like the Avengers, but the bad guy version.
Yeah, the Avengers, but the bad guy version. Yeah, but you actually see this quite a bit. Like, if we think of Harry Potter as a story, then, you know, the whole book is about this final confrontation between Harry Potter and the Dark Lord. But he fights a slew of lieutenants long before that conflict ever takes place. And so having an ensemble of antagonists offers up other things as well. So we talked about hotspots a long time ago, where you take multiple storylines climaxing and putting them really close together almost the same time. And so what you can do is a lieutenant of the villain can face off against a side character at the same time. So you'll see this a lot. Like, I think just in The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, right? Like, there's leaders of the orcs. There's the main orc fighting the main dwarf. And then you've got, you know, some of the other dwarfs fighting other bigger, tougher orcs, not just regular ones, right? So you've got multiple big fights happening all at once. And so it gives a bigger climax to the arc of the smaller characters. And then it allows you to create that hotspot, each of these conflicts occurring at the same time.
I always think of Return of the Jedi. It's got this cool lightsaber battle, like a firefight on the ground, and then a space battle.
Mm.
And they all converge.
Yeah. To create that cool conclusion.
Well, yeah. And so, like, in fact, Luke escaping just before the Death Star that he is on gets blown up. Like, just the way that overlaps so tightly is really cool.
So, yeah. So adding a string of antagonists can do a couple things. And as we mentioned before, having more than one antagonist, you can create that physical villain, political villain dynamic, which, you know, granting the immunity, be like, doesn't matter if you can win this fight. He's immune to justice until that problem, the problem of corruption is solved. Antagonist arcs. So, again, this is more about complex villains, not like the simple blanket evil ones that we talked about. And, you know, this is just having their own arcs. Their madness or their zealotry can deepen. Whatever it is that drives them can become more intense, creating an arc for them. And, you know, maybe what they're willing to do to achieve their goal becomes more extreme. You know, not only that, but they react to the protagonist as the protagonist works towards them. And that can kind of create this arc as well. I know we've mentioned this in other episodes, but faceless forces need faces.
That's great. Yeah.
Because of empathy and the way humans are wired to react emotionally to other humans, it is best when the antagonist has a face, a person who represents the evil empire, like Darth Vader. Right. That is his purpose. He gives face to the empire. Mm. You know, yeah, there's a sea of stormtroopers all the same, but Vader, he stands out, you know, and he's former evil. I remember in The Rainmaker, Matt Damon, he goes up against a corrupt insurance company. It's just, you know, a big corporation. But there is a very slick and kind of, greasy lawyer who leads the opposing legal defense team, and he then is the face of the opposition.
That's cool.
You know, so I mean, every time they come into a room, there's like 20 lawyers that walk in, but he's the one who does all the talking, you know, and everything. So, but yeah, it just allows the audience to focus their frustration and hate on a person instead of a vague entity. And it is more satisfying emotionally because it can come down to a final confrontation between two people.
Yeah, it's, man, in my English classes that I used to teach, I would teach the abstraction ladder, and we'd talk about the difference between saying animals, like I'm thinking of an animal, like that's so abstract, versus I'm thinking about Bessie. Like Bessie is a very specific cow. And I think in all writing, moving from abstract to specific is helpful.
Yeah.
And this is essentially that principle, saying it's okay to have an abstract villainous force, but make it specific too, so that you can like latch onto it.
Okay, so we already talked about Kick the Cat, and that's so I just wanted to.
I still think we need Throttle the Dog.
Throttle the Dog. I don't know what Throttle the Dog would be, because I mean, making them relatable is about complicating them. They're already unrelatable because they do terrible things, right?
Okay.
So Kick the Cat. Yeah, just remember to set up that first impression in a way that kind of skews everything towards the negative with them. So particularly if you plan to complicate them. You know, if you've just got a blanket evil villain, you don't need to worry about Kick the Cat. They're kicking the cat every scene they're on stage. But with a complicated villain, you need to make sure you set that piece first.
Yeah.
So, and allow your antagonist some victories, you know, let them win a few rounds, or even most of the rounds up until the climactic moment. But this is part of establishing that imbalance of power that they are stronger, and that's so important to have, you know, to make our heroes heroic. And I guess finally, it comes down to love and hate. The trick to great villains is getting the reader to love that they hate them or hate that they love them, right? And so the outcome is really simple to explain here, but the rest is tricky, right? Like, I love to hate Voldemort. It's easy. He's vile. He's evil. He's terrible. You can hate him and you don't feel any regret. Yeah, just hate him. You know, you wish you could be the one to face off against him just for that satisfying end to this terribleness. And you feel good about that, right? Whereas I kind of hate that I love Walter White.
This is that TV show?
So this is from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, yeah.
So he essentially is a meth crime lord, or at least he becomes one, right? He makes drugs, he feeds addicts, he kills people.
You hate that you love him.
Because he, like Voldemort, is vile. He kills people, he tortures people, he does all kinds of terrible stuff. He kills his brother-in-law, right? Straight up. And yet, I feel bad for him. And despite all the terrible things he's done, I kind of want him to win. You know?
That's awesome.
So that is that I hate that I love him. You know? I mean, I know that he's terrible. Like, there's a logical part of my brain that says you don't Walter White is not your protagonist, but there's a part of my brain that says, yeah, but I like him. I understand where he's coming from because we've been on this journey together.
Dude, that's awesome.
And so those are the two outcomes you really want when it's said and done. Walter White is a complicated villain. He has had save the cat moments. He has had pet the dog moments. I understand how he got to where he is. I understand his motivations.
And wait, so would you, if you're calling him the villain, would you say that the cops are the protagonists?
Well, the cops are definitely antagonists, but he is the villain. The cops are the heroes. He is the villain, but he's the protagonist. They're the antagonist.
Okay.
Just the way the story is structured.
Interesting.
You know, but yeah. And so that's kind of how you want them to walk away from it. With a blanket evil villain, they can just have somebody they hate and feel good about hating them, and it's okay. And, you know, if you want a complicated villain, then you need the opposite. You need them to say, I kind of get where they're coming from. Like, I'll never forget, one of my readers was talking about Alvaro, one of my villains, and he says, I know he's a villain, but I understand him. I get it. And I was like, yes. That's awesome. That's good.
That's good feedback.
That's good feedback. So that is it, unless you have anything else.
No.
On antagonists and villains, part 2.
Another excellent episode. So.
All right. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Bendosky. So at the end of this month, The Nature of Skyfall Events is coming out. It's a nonfiction book. So within my own novel, there's a book constantly references like the source of how they're going to do all these crazy things. And that book is The Nature of Skyfall Events. So the fans of the series have constantly emailed me trying to find and buy this book only to realize that it didn't exist. So I am compiling it and putting it together, and I'm going to be releasing it at the end of this month. And at the end of next month, The Skyfall Conspiracy is coming out. So this is, I'll talk about that more next time. But it's a project I've been working on for a long time, and I'm very excited about it.
Awesome. And I guess I'm going to do a little pitch too. So I've been working on a space opera, and a little backstory for the author. I grew up as a Star Wars fan, a massive Star Wars fan when I was a kid. And I feel like Star Wars did not grow up as I grew up.
Oh.
And so I wanted the same exciting space adventure that I loved as a kid, but I wanted it to mature too.
That is exactly what Star Child is. Oh my gosh.
So Joe just read it. He's one of my early readers. So I've written this space adventure that has everything you love about Star Wars, but it's a little more mature. It asks you to think a little more, a little deeper, a little richer characters. I'm launching this book on May 4th, 2019. That's Star Wars Day. It's up for pre-order now. If you go to starchild.jwashburn.com, it'll take you to the buy now page. And I would love to have you read it. I'm super excited to hear what you think.
And if you are interested in a free copy, if you email Jay, he will probably send you a review copy so you can have reviews out on day one.
I would love to do that. I hadn't even thought of that. I will do this.
Yes, he will happily do that. Yeah.
My email address is me@jwashburn.com. That's just the letter J, jwashburn.com.
So, all right. Thanks for listening. So the show notes, when I ever get around to updating the website, will be at josephbendosky.com, or you can put the dash in there. I now own both, so we're good.
Awesome.
So yeah, Joseph Bendosky or joseph-bendosky.com. And then there's a sub portal for Start Writing. It's the home page of the site where whatever articles we have are up there. I will mention that my book, The Broken Protocol Conspiracy, is a novella. I've gotten a few emails from some of you about this. I did a big promotion on it at the beginning of March. I sold over 2,000 copies in one day. Hit number 66 on Amazon.
That's so cool, dude.
So as we prepare to launch Star Child, I'm probably going to be putting together some tutorials for Jay on putting together everything from his email chain to just setting up the promotions and building his list just so I know, so he can get it done really fast. Because multiple times during my own author journey, I was like, I wish someone would just hold my hand through this. I just didn't have to, you know, read the article and then stumble through this. And so that's kind of what I'm going to be putting together. So we'll let you know how that goes and when that's available. Right now, I'm just drowning in my own deadlines. But at some point, we'll get those put together. So if you're interested, we'll put links. Well, I guess we'll probably put them on the site, and then they'll be on the YouTube page, which I know nobody sees. The episodes go to YouTube, believe it or not. But so there's a, yeah. But yeah, so we'll get those up, and hopefully you'll enjoy those, and they'll help Jay get Star Child launched as well.
And guys, you've been listening to us for a couple of years, and we've been working on these projects for a long time, and we're so excited.
This is the year.
To send
this
them is to it. You. But man, I'm only halfway through Joe's book, but it is excellent. Definitely the best thing that he has read, that he's written.
Yeah.
And anyway, we're excited to share.
All right. Thanks for listening.